Okay. And are you close to your microphone? Because we can't hear you very well either.
I'm actually not close to a microphone, but everybody else is. Can you hear me now?
Okay. That was much better. So. Well, I think we do have some legislators that are trying to get online, so we'll, as they come online, we'll acknowledge them. Our LIO moderator and Liesl McGuire staff was nice enough to help us out today, and that's Shalon Szymanski, and thank you very much for being with us. And before we start, I'd like to remind everybody that when we're online like this and we're far away, that please identify yourselves just before you speak. If we do that, I'll try to acknowledge you. And anyone online, please make sure that you introduce yourself by telling us your name and your affiliation so we know where you're coming from. So our agenda today is going to include status of personal care attendant regulations, House Bill 303, Adult Companion Service Waivers, the report, the status of the long-term care report, and also House Bill 271, limit overtime for registered nurses. And then at the end, we'll kind of have a summary of whether we do have any kind of a health care crisis or not. So I think we'll start out, first of all, by getting that our first item will be the status of the personal care attendant regulations. And I think the public comment period for that ended just last Monday, if I'm correct.
Yeah, Monday the 15th.
Yeah, and so I know you haven't had time to get it all pulled together, but can you, you're John Sherwood, right?
Yes.
Okay. John, why don't you go ahead and kind of tell us tentatively what you've been able to gather and pull together from that right now.
Okay. Thank you. For the record, I'm John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Service in the Office of Program Review. And as the committee is aware, the FY06 budget included intent language directing the department to make changes to our Medicaid personal care program, mostly around cost containment and program integrity. There are actually 14 points listed. So in late May, we held a public meeting to gather input before actually proposing regulations. Using the public input, we published proposed regulations amending the personal care program on July 12th. On August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, we held public workshops in Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage with teleconference participation as well at all of these workshops. And at these workshops, we explained our proposed regulations to the public and answered questions about how we expected them to work. The goal there was to make sure that people really understood what we were trying to do, so when we got public comments, they would be as informed comments as possible. On August 9, 10, and 11, we held public hearings to receive oral comments on the regs, again in Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage. The Juneau and Fairbanks hearings were also teleconferenced. And as the chair pointed out, we closed our public comment on August 15th. We received a large volume of public comments, some of it very detailed. We're in the process of reviewing and considering these comments right now. We hope to be able to send our revised regulations to the Department of Law for review sometime in mid to late September. And have them filed with the Lieutenant Governor in time to become effective later this calendar year, but before the start of the next calendar year. And the main feature of the regulations, probably the biggest pieces, had to do with introducing a standardized assessment tool to be used for all personal care recipients. Currently, each agency uses its own assessment tool. And to have that assessment administered by the state or state contractor and not by the PCA agency itself, and also to implement clearer standards for providers. And we know as a result of some of the public comments, we're going to have to make some adjustments to our proposed regulations and attempting to propose changes. We didn't actually connect everything up as neatly as we should. So we'll figure out those changes to be made. and provide that for the commissioner to adopt. Again, we're hoping sometime later in September. And that's where we are right now.
It's always good to know that the system works, that the public comment is going to make a difference, and so that's encouraging for me to see that when we put something into place and when we have this public comment, that the department does listen and hears what people say. I don't always feel that in every department we hear things like that. So I think that's very, I commend you on that and am very pleased to hear that. So thank you. Does anybody in the committee have any questions or any comments? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, was there any particular area of these 14 points that you received the most comments on and seemed to be most necessary of revision?
With specific regard to the 14 points, I think the two areas we probably received the most comments on was there was a lot of concern with the standardized assessment and having it performed by the state. Some of it is just unfamiliarity with the new assessment tool, but a lot of it has to do with the state's ability to get out and perform these assessments in a timely manner, especially in the more remote parts of the state. We have attempted in our regulations to make some provisions for kind of, I don't want to say emergency authorization, but short-term authorization in questions of an urgent need for care. We may make some further revisions to that, and we're looking at how we can also maybe put some kind of guaranteed time into our regulation that would ensure that folks get access to some level of service if we do have difficulties getting an assessment. I think the other area around these 14 points, one of the points was to prior authorize all services, all personal care services. There's some concern, again, that this could complicate the administration process and the billing process for providers. To have a prior authorized service, you need to be issued a prior authorized number, connect that number to the client and the agency to which it's authorized. And this is a little more paperwork and a little more management that folks have to do. If the state doesn't issue those prior authorization numbers in a timely fashion, communicate them to providers, it can slow down their payment. There's concerns about our ability to do that. We're looking at that, and I think before we go forward with that, we'll need to know that we can provide those prior authorization numbers in a timely fashion, but at this point it's still our intent to do so.
Okay, it's going to be interesting too, and we won't know the reason for this, because in a few different hot spots we found that there was some abuse of the program, and that's kind of why we're having to do all this. And we won't be able to tell this year, really, this session, but maybe by the next session we will be able to see if there's a difference. And that's going to be a little bit hard, because we know that there's more people coming online all the time, too. So to see if there's going to make a difference, we'll just have to wait and see. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this month's October 05 issue of Governing Magazine, they have an interview with Mike Leavitt, Commissioner or Secretary of Federal Health and Social Services. And one of the things he's talking about in there and ideas for Medicaid reform is that states shouldn't need a waiver to use home and community care with a long-term population. Have we received any indications from the federal government that they are implementing any changes that would impact the regulations that we're modifying now? I mean, it seems like they're thinking along the same lines that some changes need to be made.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, states have the ability to provide personal care as part of their regular state plan and outside of the waiver process. That is how Alaska provides its waiver currently, or provides its personal care services currently, is as a state plan service. So proposed changes to eliminate the waiver requirement wouldn't affect these regulations. They'd affect some other services that we provide. And I'm not aware of anything that's been proposed in terms of federal Medicaid reform that would directly affect these regulations. There's a couple of generic things that have been discussed, like a total cap on Medicaid administrative expenses allowed by the states, which would, you know, affect all of our administration, not particular to personal care, but just across the board would affect the program, but nothing specific to this program.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. John, early on we talked about Odette making comments. Is she going to make any comments, or are we?
I don't believe she wants to make comments
okay.
at this time. So.
All right, then. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Our next agenda item is a report on House Bill 303, Adult Companion Service Waiver. And by the way, the record show that quite some time ago that Representative Tom Anderson has joined us. We have Janet Clark and John Sherwood again from the Department of Health and Social Services here to help us on this report. And I guess I kind of would like to start out the report, or at least if you could explain to us just exactly what is a Medicaid waiver, because you know, we hear that thrown around all the time, but I'm not sure everybody really understands exactly what that means.
Madam Chair, Janet Clark, for the record. I think I'll have John Sherwood explain what a Medicaid waiver is and some of the history of Medicaid waivers in the state of Alaska. That might help the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. A Medicaid waiver is a device allowed under federal law to bypass the normal limits that federal Medicaid law and regulation would impose on a state in operating a Medicaid program. So under normal federal law, there are certain services you can provide and certain services you can't provide. A waiver essentially lets you provide services that aren't normally allowed under federal law, but it sets some conditions around that provision of service. And when we talk about waivers in Alaska, usually what we're talking about are the home and community-based service waivers, which is one kind of waiver that you can get from the federal government. There are some other kinds of waivers. I won't go into those today. But under a home and community-based services waiver, the state is allowed to provide certain services as an alternative to institutional care, as an alternative to nursing home care, or commonly also for an alternative for institutions for the mentally retarded and developmentally disabled, like our old Harborview facility in Valdez. And the characteristics of these waivers are that the states have to define the services they're going to offer. And the federal government has predefined some services, but states can make up their own definitions. That have to be reasonably related to meeting the needs of the target population. The states define the type of people served, the level of care. Are they going to serve people who would qualify for nursing homes? Are they going to serve people who would qualify for the institutions for the mentally retarded, or what we call ICFMRs? And states can add special targeting criteria to that. We could make a waiver for people who would be served by a nursing home and who are quadriplegics, if we wanted.
John, have you said that the states can kind of make up their own definitions? Has Alaska done that?
Alaska has pretty much stayed with the standard definitions, with some modifications, kind of slight modifications, sometimes around the way we license a particular kind of service. But pretty much we've moved, anything that was non-standard to begin with, we tended to standardize. It's simpler for us to administer with the federal government. When we use their definition, there's less review of what that definition means and what we're trying to do. So, you know, as much as we can, we like to keep them out of our hair. But as part of the process of submitting a waiver, the state has to specify the number of people to be served. And in this regard, waivers are different from the rest of Medicaid, where if you meet the basic eligibility criteria, it's an entitlement. You get it. If you apply, you meet the criteria, you get it. Under waivers, we tell the federal government how many people we're going to serve, and that's the limit on the number of people we can serve. And so it's not a pure entitlement. Even if you meet all the eligibility criteria, if we don't have the authority to add more people to our waiver, you are not entitled to get the waivered services.
Now, what about if someone comes, someone moves up here, that would be entitled to it in the middle of the fiscal year? What happens then?
We can add people at any time during the year as long as we have authority with the federal government to serve that additional person. For example, in our I don't know the actual number off the top of my head, but let's say in our waiver that which serves older Alaskans, we have authority to serve 1,500 people a year. If we have served 1,450, we can add another person, no problem. As we get up to 1,500, then we couldn't cross that line unless we applied to the federal government for authority to serve additional people. And the kicker there is that part of what we do to get our waiver approved is show that our waiver is cost neutral, that we are not going to spend more money on people at home or in a community setting than we would if they were in institutions. And there's a formula, a pretty complicated formula you have to submit with where you define about 15 different factors and plug in all the numbers and prove that you're not going to spend more money than if you just serve people in institutions. And so anytime you want to change the number of people you serve, you have to resubmit that formula and along with the number. Now, Alaska has four waivers. It serves older Alaskans, people 65 and older who meet nursing home level of care, serves adults with physical disabilities, which are people between the age of 21 and 64 who meet nursing home level of care. We have a waiver for children with complex medical conditions, which serves children up through the age of 21 who'd either be served in a nursing home or really more commonly in Alaska, long-term hospitalization in a long-term pediatric ward in a hospital. And then a waiver for people with mental retardation or developmental disabilities. These are people of all ages who would meet the institutional standard for the intermediate care facility for the mentally retarded, the ICFMR. And this is our classic DD population is served through this waiver. At any given time, we serve about 2,800 people on waivers. Now, people come and go from the waivers in the course of the year. I think in 05, we served a little under 3,600 people total through the course of the year. On the four waivers. We have had these waivers since late in 1993. Alaska was one of the last states to get a home and community-based waiver. When we got a waiver, we got waivers to serve people of all ages for both nursing home and ICFMR level of care. States don't have to provide that much coverage. Some states only provide waivers for adults or only provide waivers for children, only provide waivers for nursing home care, or only provide waivers for ICFMR, although I think it's pretty common that most states have a reasonable mix of waivers serving both populations. The other thing about Alaska's waiver is our breadth of services are actually pretty wide. You don't have to have a lot of services in your waivers. Some states might have a waiver that offered paid for only care in an assisted living home, or maybe respite care and chore service, but not a lot of other services. In Alaska, our waivers offer care coordination, payment for services in assisted living facilities, adult daycare, private duty nursing, respite, chore, meals, social transportation, environmental modification, specialized equipment and supplies, and a wide range of habilitative services for people with developmental disabilities. In terms of the services we offer, Odette may think of one or two that I've forgotten, but probably the companion service is about the only major kind of service under waivers that we don't offer for these populations. So, and I think that's about, as I mentioned, we have to submit these waivers to the federal government for approval, and each waiver requires filling out about a 60 to 80 page document with some backup materials. The initial approval period is 3 years. When you renew them, they're renewed every 5 years. We're actually coming up on a renewal. This fiscal year, we'll be putting together our submission to get renewed for 5 more years, beginning at the start of the next fiscal year, for all 4 of our waivers. Before the waivers are renewed, you undergo a federal review of your waivers, which we underwent about a year ago. They kind of got off schedule with Alaska, and so normally it would be a little closer to the end of our waiver, but we got ours just about midway through the course of our waiver. And we are going to have to make some provide some documentation. We expect around our quality assurance methods based on that review, that they'll want to see some more documentation on that. So that's where we stand. It's a basic background on what a waiver is and what Alaska has in terms of waivers. I think we spent over $100 million in FY05 on our 4 waivers, approaching $110 million. So, and we, by comparison, at any given time, we have a little over 500 people in nursing homes. And like I said, at any given time, we have about 2,800 people on our waivers. So that's kind of, I think Alaska has been very successful at using waivers to avoid institutionalization. And really, our nursing home bed days have been relatively flat over the last 12 years since we implemented waivers, even though we have a very fast-growing population of seniors.
Thank you. Could you get us a list of the 4 waivers and then what services you give underneath each of those?
Sure, we can provide that.
That would be great for us to be able to visualize
okay. That.
I've got a feeling it'll just help us to understand exactly all the different services that Alaska has available. For the record, I'd like it to be noted that Representative Sisna has called into the meeting. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's awfully hot here.
Okay.
You've got to be happy to be where you are.
Oh, that's right. You're in Washington, D.C., right?
Yeah. just spent my afternoon at a biotech facility. Very interesting.
Ah. Okay. Thank you very much, John. And Janet, you're going to kind of go into a little bit more for us then.
I am. Madam Chairman, I'd like to begin by first just going over briefly House Bill 303. The legislation was introduced May 5th, fairly late in the session, but I think most members of the committee are familiar with some of the basic sections in the bill. The first section is legislative intent, basically dealing with the personal care attendant program, and I think Mr. Sherwood gave you an update on that and the 14 points that we've gone out to for regulation on already. If you look on page 2 at the bottom, subsection B starts to lay out that this legislation that there's the intent to restore some non-medical care, supervision, and socialization services through what we're calling companion services. So that's the statement of legislative intent that's out in the bill. And then Section 2 really just outlines the direction from the legislature to seek assistance for an additional waiver that, again, we're calling companion care for services for older Alaskans and adults with physical disabilities, and basically outlines, at least in this legislation, some of the direction from the legislature to do that. Again, I think this committee saw this language in several different other bills. If you look through the legislative history, House Bill 125, 193, tucked in very many places throughout the session. So this is the final bill.
Wherever Sharon could put it.
Wherever it could show up. So on the legislation itself, I just have a couple of comments first before we take questions and review the first the fiscal note. The department's position on this legislation is that we believe that this type of service is really premature to pass this type of legislation at this point. The department is currently doing a long-term care study, and that study will help us evaluate what services are needed in the continuum of care. And to just pass this legislation before that study is complete, we think that is a bit premature. We also believe that what the department knows about our current service system, and Mr. Sherwood can go into this a little bit later, is that there's the way that our service system is built up, if we just add this additional service on top of it without looking at all the other components, that it's going to provide some inefficiencies and probably some cost in how we do business, that we basically, to package this service in, I think we really need to look wholesale at all the services that Mr. Sherwood described, particularly in our waiver services. As I said, the department has been taking some steps to look forward into our Medicaid program. Those of you who are on our budget subcommittee may recall that the legislature authorized some funds for assessment and planning. Representative Hawker was instrumental in that. And we currently have the Lewin Group under contract with us, and that contractor is helping us develop a better long-term forecast for Medicaid. And as part of that, the Lewin Group is taking a look at the state demographics and outlining the type of services we're using, and based on those demographics, helping us kind of look to the future of what our service array would look like, basically if we don't change anything with our different growth and population. So that's going to be very valuable information that we're going to have before the start of the session. And then, as I said, we're also embarking on the long-term care study. We just sent out the notice of intent to award to, you were on the PEC, John.
Right, the public consulting group.
Right, that will help help the state and provide the information the state and the legislature and other advocacy groups that, along that line. So we believe that both of these studies are trying to help us get a handle not only on the Medicaid budget, but our Medicaid program, particularly for home and community-based care and other kind of services, and will help us give some advice to the executive branch and the legislature on how best to structure our Medicaid program for the future. You know, I do the budget for the department, and I don't like it any better than the legislature when I have to come before the legislature to say, we need $30 million for our Medicaid program this year, or, you know, the federal government has turned us down for this or that, and you need to help fill the gaps. It's not pleasant for either of us, although maybe it's easier if oil's at $70 a barrel. I don't know. It'd be interesting to try. But, you know, we always feel that we have a fiduciary responsibility for the use of our state funds. And we do feel like we've been struggling to try to be as cost-effective as possible in our Medicaid program, but it's very difficult to do that without coming to the legislature for additional money. So we want to make sure that as we go forward that we don't lose those really important services that we're currently offering, some of the home and community services that are costing us almost $110 million. So before we add additional services, again, we really struggle with that. I would like to spend a little bit of time reviewing the fiscal note, and I hope it is in your packet. We had to kind of rush around a little bit to find the fiscal note because the fiscal note had been submitted on these other pieces of legislation, but we hadn't actually submitted one for House Bill 303 until, I think, last week. So hopefully you did get that.
I think
that.
We'll get that. If you have it? Okay. I'm looking at
the
draft
back
of the bill.
If you look inside, is it the draft
one
you're looking at?
It says draft.
Okay. Yes. We do have.
Because since this is an interim discussion, we've submitted that.
Before you continue, Representative Gardner has a question for
you. Thank you. The assessment planning being done by the Lewin Group and also the other long-term care study, do you have any kind of timeline, any idea when that information would be available?
The Lewin Group is well underway. Actually, Representative Hawker has come to some of our steering committee meetings,
mm-hmm.
as well as his staff. We are definitely going to have information for the legislature by January, and we'll probably have that well ahead of time. I think based on our current timeline, we should have information in November.
Could you, when you, at least a summary of what they found out, could you forward that to me so that I can share it with the committee members?
We'd be happy to do that. I think the demographic information and looking into the future, they're having to do some work on Alaska's population cohorts in different levels, and it's going to be very interesting as we see how that's going to fit with our Medicaid service array.
Okay. I'm really excited about this because I think, it's so easy to continue doing what we're doing, and when something else comes on, add that to it, and then when that happens, when we keep adding extra pieces, then we get duplication of services, and one group doesn't know what the other group's doing. So this is really, I think, will be very beneficial. So I'm kind of excited about hearing what they come up with.
And on the long-term care study, John, do you want to talk about? I can't recall the timeline on that.
The long-term care study, as Janet said, we just issued the notice of intent to award, and we'll probably have the contractor officially on board about September 15th. Begin work, and we should have a final report. It's scheduled to be done by February 10th, according to the terms of our RFP. So we may get some interim information before that, but we'll definitely have the final report by mid-February.
So we probably, at least by the end of session, we'll have for sure both reports in. Good. Yes. Any other questions from anyone from the committee? Okay.
Okay, Madam Chairman, just looking at the fiscal note on House Bill 303, again, this is draft because, we're altering to our formal submission process since you aren't in session at the time. As I said, we're under constant scrutiny to look at our Medicaid budget, and we really have been trying to be consistent, cost-effective, and to really be good stewards of the public money. If you look on page one, you can see that what we basically do in this fiscal note is just move the years 1 year forward from what you've seen in the past. We are basically projecting that in fiscal year 2007, if this bill were to pass and we did regulations to add the service halfway through that fiscal year, we would add that service. So we believe the cost would be approximately $10,759,600. And then you can see in FY 2008, you get a full year worth of costs for that program, and then the costs escalate forward so that in 2011, we project that adding the service would cost over $31 million.
Janet, now exactly what services would that be? Just give us an example that they're not getting now.
I think on the second page, we actually maybe can answer your question. What we tried to cost out here was what you call in legislation companion services, which are to restore non-medical care, supervision, and socialization services. And part of our cost model was basically that companion services would not replace any other services, but would be in addition to existing services. And a particular note here is that it would also allow the primary caregiver to sleep during normal nighttime hours when the care recipient may not be safely alone. And that's a pretty significant part of the cost when you factor that in. So, Madam Chairman, if you look on page 2 in kind of the middle of the fiscal note, we're just kind of running the numbers here. There are currently 1,915 recipients of older Alaskan and adults with physical disability waiver services. Of those, approximately 570 reside in assisted living homes that would not be eligible. So we take those off the top to begin with. So you take the 1,345, and we just estimate that 10% of them, that approximately 10% have caregivers who would utilize companion services for 10 hours per day to allow them to work full-time. So somebody goes to work, they want a companion in the home. They're not doing any of the other services that we talked about, so we would add those on at that cost. At $19.72 per hour, that's the median cost for unskilled respite care workers. That's the best information we had, so that's what we used. Then for overnight supervision, again, we are based on the assumption that 10% of the 1,340 recipients would be in need of overnight companion services. And if we limit those to 9 hours per evening and 3 nights per week, the cost calculates out to $3,737.70 for 135 recipients per year. And then of the approximately 1,200 recipients who do not qualify for work-related or overnight companion services, the department estimates that 90% would utilize basic companion services limited to 10 hours per week. So that's just over a week's time. We estimate that the rest of the group we're talking about would have 10 hours of those services that come in. So, Madam Chairman, we actually think we've done a pretty good job, fairly conservative cost estimate, if these services were added without these other studies happening and how we might configure services to calculating what the cost would be. And I know it's startling, but it does all add up to those millions of dollars that are outlined on page 1.
Madam Chair?
Representative McGuire?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. So in the study, one of the things I hope you're looking at that Representative Cisna pointed out and where this could be helpful is there may be folks who are staying in more of an institution-like setting who could live in their home if this were an option. In other words, having a personal care attendant may not be enough for them. For example, the overnight situation where you have somebody who you've got to watch, you know, throughout the night. I don't know how many people that would be, but I'd be interested in an analysis of, you know, if there's a population out there that is costing X amount of dollars per year to live where they are now, if they could live in a home environment with the assistance of a PCA and the adult companion services. So I think that was kind of what she was advocating for. Quality of life is certainly one thing, and I think, you know, that's a point that you're making, that there will be a percentage of folks who want to improve their quality of life and will add this on and probably qualify, even if you ran it the way you are proposing to run the PCA, where you have to get prior authorization. There'll be folks that qualify, and certainly their health and quality of life will be improved. But I think the question is, are there any of those folks that will actually save the state money or create a neutral?
Through the chair, Representative McGuire, I'll take a stab first and then have Mr. Sherwood kind of add his comments. We did not calculate any offsetting costs. To actually qualify to be in a nursing home, you have to meet the nursing home level of care. And as you probably know, we have really constrained the growth of nursing homes in the state of Alaska for the last 10 to 15 years, with a CON moratorium and, you know, the increase in other home and community-based care, as John outlined. We, at one point, before we had these home and community-based services, our only a source of services for seniors were nursing homes.
Mm-hmm.
We had 500 nursing home beds. Well, we still have 500 nursing home beds, and we have, you know, 2,800 or 3,600 people being served in home and community-based care. So it's our... I think it's our belief, and we have kind of done some analysis, not an in-depth analysis, that unless you were to actively close nursing home beds, that those beds would be available for those people who really need those services. And there are some waiting lists. I mean, there are some areas that really individuals who need that very, very high level of care. Companion services in and by itself would not provide that high level of service for someone in a nursing home. So you would have to marry it up with personal care attendant services or waiver services or some other services. And as we've seen, we've been fairly lucky as a state to just keep nursing home, the number of nursing home beds fairly flat and static. And so we're basically believing that that would continue in the future. But John, see if he has any other comments.
Well, I think, through the chair, I think Janet really addressed the nursing home issue really well. Another question that comes up is what about keeping people out of an assisted living home in their own home? And probably companion services would allow that to happen, and that is very well a desirable goal if that's what people really want. But where you're talking about situations where folks need extensive overnight supervision or daytime supervision while somebody is out of the house working, we really think that the kind of wages we would have to pay to get workers would be comparable to personal care, respite care, those other services, right around the $20 an hour mark. And when you're providing companion services on a large scale like that, there isn't much economy of scale as you would get in an assisted living home. So we don't really expect to save money by keeping those people with more intense supervision needs out of assisted living homes in companion services. There might be individual cases where we save money, but there will also be cases where we would spend more money, you know, wrapping around the services to one person. And under the waiver, while you have an overall cost neutrality, once you offer a service and put it out there, you don't have a lot of ability to restrict that single service as long as you're cheaper than an institution. So, you know, we can put absolute controls on the amount of service that of companion services somebody could get, but to make sure we save money, that probably still wouldn't address those people who we would be, you know, most people who would go into an assisted living facility. And if we opened it up to prevent, you know, that, you know, to make that choice available to everybody, we don't expect that we would really save money because of the cost of providing that one-on-one intensive service. Unfortunately, institutions and congregate living settings do have economies of scale. So even though it sounds like it should be cheaper, it isn't always cheaper.
Representative Cisna, you had a question?
I did, as a matter of fact. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I actually have
Can you
couple.
Speak up a little bit? We can barely hear you.
Oh, pardon me. I'm sorry. Nick, can you hear me now?
A little bit better, but
I guess what I have a couple questions, one of which is the regulations do have companion services listed in them, and I've seen a copy of that. It's not one that has been implemented, but it is listed in the waiver services that the state does adhere to. And if, in fact, the department doesn't know what I mean, I'll have to get back to my office to make a copy of the papers that I got from the state that show that. But that would make a difference in terms of the timing. I have been, in the past several weeks, I've been, involved in several different workshops talking about senior services, and have been networking now with some of the legislators from other states. And what it sounds like is that our state is going through some of the things that other states had gone through in the past. And they find now the same thing that our legislative research found in their 2004 study, which was that, yes, it's true that companion services might be, what we had in place in terms of home health care workers, if you look at the worst-case scenario, it can get pretty expensive, but the average is, what is it, $50-some dollars a day or whatever that is, significantly less than nursing home care. And I'd like to hear the department's comments about that.
Sure. To the chair, Representative Sisna, I think we would agree that on average our home and community-based services are significantly less expensive than institutional care. I think what we see is, with regard to companion services, is that we don't think companion services would really reduce significantly the amount of institutional care we pay for. We already do a pretty impressive job about serving people through the home and community, and have a relatively small percentage of our folks served in institutional care. Out of at any given time, about 3,300 people, only about 500 are in nursing homes as opposed to home and community-based care. I don't think we have an argument that our home and community-based system is cost-effective, even if we add it compared to nursing homes, even if we added the companion services. We just don't really think that we think that it would still increase our overall expenditures on waivers to add companion services that wouldn't be offset by a decline in nursing home use.
So what you're saying, John, is that probably the ones that are in the nursing homes are going to stay there, and this would probably just increase services to the people that aren't in nursing homes.
Right. I think, you know, kind of simply and to overgeneralize a little bit, people use nursing homes as a last resort, and we think that we're pretty much already there at the point where it's a last resort. And
did you have any other comments, Representative
Sisna? I did, as a matter of fact. Well, we've gone through a set of regulations both in the interim in 04, and now we're going through another set of regulation changes. And having attended the hearings that were held several weeks ago, having talked to numerous seniors over the past several months, I'm getting a real strong reaction in terms of just real confusion on the changes that are being put into place. And I was really happy to hear Janet Clark talking about that didn't want to put in more changes when there hadn't been the studies done. And that seems to me, since we went through the changes last summer, there were a number of folks who were real concerned about the effects of those and continuing to have concern about that. The newest changes, that are another very difficult thing that happens right on top of the Medicare changes, which, according to the workshop today, they said we should be tripling and quadrupling our state efforts at getting people ready to make those decisions that have got to be made. And I haven't seen a reaction to that, and I'd love to get a briefing on that from the department real soon on how the state is going to deal with that. But I just would like to ask the department why. I mean, this was put out there as an effort to try to stem some of the effect of the changes that went into place last summer, and we're doing another whole set of changes. And If the department is figuring out how to balance these, these changes for seniors, it's incredibly brutal.
Representative, you had a question?
Well, yeah, I was just trying to clarify in my mind what John was talking about. Are you saying that the adult companion services are really corresponding to not to nursing homes, but to assisted living homes, and that those are the, so that when we look at cost comparisons and comparison of services, we shouldn't even be talking about nursing homes, but it's assisted living homes versus companion services, is that correct?
That's correct. I think, you know, that you'd always want to allow for you know, an individual exception for a particular case, but by and large, we think that probably companion services, the bigger effect would, it would allow people to remain in their own home as opposed to moving into an assisted living facility rather than moving into a nursing home.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other comments from anyone? Okay, thank you very much. I think that kind of from overall what I'm hearing then is there are a lot of questions, but I think it would be well for us to just sit back and wait until we get two reports back and then kind of see where everything stacks up before we decide what we're going to do next. Okay. Thank you. Okay. That leads us now. We kind of, that kind of pulled, do you have anything else to say about long-term care, or that kind of was pulled together, or what do you think, John?
I think we've pretty much hit the high points, Madam Chair, with regard to our long-term care study and the schedule. If you have any additional questions about it at this time, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Anybody have any questions on that? I guess not. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Now we're going to kind of jump right into House Bill 271, which is the limit of the overtime for registered nurses. And that's kind of the culmination of this meeting that we're having today. And what I'm there is a sign-up sheet in the back for anybody that would like to testify. So if anyone that wants to testify hasn't signed up, please sign up. And anyone that's online that wants to testify, please let the LIO person know so that we can have all that. Because it is my intention, at this time that we are going to hear all the testimony from anyone that wants to give us their thoughts on it. And normally, when we're in session, we kind of have to limit this to 3 minutes because there's so many people. But today I think that because we've gone pretty fast here, I would like to be able to really get a good feeling of why this bill came about and also people's feelings on it. So I'm not going to limit the testimony, although be very aware that if someone else has made several comments about what you want to talk about, you know, you don't have to go into it in detail again, but we don't want to stifle any testimony either. So,
Madam Chairman?
Yes?
I'm sorry. This is Connie Sipe from Sitka.
Yes.
You're talking about public testimony on 271. Are you going to ask or allow for public testimony on 303?
No, we just really kind of have come to the conclusion that we're going to kind of wait. There's more work to be done on a lot of that yet, and so I'm very open to hearing more about that. If you want to call my office or any of us, you're welcome to do that. But I think because of all the testimony that we